90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, we kind of wrap up our series that we've been talking about COVID vaccinations. And our guest is Ray Delecki, and he's the Community Health Division Manager for Jackson County. And we're going to discuss the mask mandate for Jackson County, vaccinations, and COVID rates in Jackson County. Good morning, Ray. Are you with us, sir?
Good morning. Yes.
So, Ray, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself? Are you originally from Kansas City?
Yeah, of course. So I was born and raised right here in Kansas City, Kansas City metro area. I'm proud to still call this city home. My professional life, I've worked in public health for about 10 years. I've got an undergrad degree in exercise physiology, and my master's degree is in public health with an emphasis in epidemiology and health administration and policy.
So how long have you worked for the Jackson County Health Department?
Yeah, so I've been about at this health department for about 5 years. Initially as a community health division manager, just got actually promoted to assistant health director about a year ago.
So, what are your duties as the assistant health director for Jackson County?
Yeah, so as the assistant health director in normal times, I oversee communications, our community health efforts, our health promotion efforts, our policy work. However, that has shifted, obviously, with COVID. And so during COVID, I've primarily been responsible for a lot of logistical items, helping with vaccination clinics, testing clinics, as far as getting those set up, the research and strategy, trying to stay up to date on the science and what we know about COVID. And then just really a number of activities centering around general response in a responsible manner.
And I know, Ray, sometimes people can get confused. Kansas City has a health department. What cities are covered by Jackson County Health Department? What cities are not covered by the Jackson County Health Department?
Of course. Yeah, it is very confusing. I will certainly admit to that. So the Jackson County Health Department will cover all of Jackson County, excluding the city limits of Kansas City and Independence. Both of those communities have their own health departments, and we will cover everyone else, basically.
So, Ray, can residents who live, though, in Kansas City and Independence come to the Jackson County Health Department to receive services, or must they receive services from the city in which they reside?
Of course. So we actually have a long history of offering services for really anyone who lives here in Jackson County, regardless of if you're in Kansas City or Independence. And this is especially true with COVID. You know, COVID knows no jurisdictional lines or boundaries or state lines or any of those sort of things. So, you know, anyone, as far as COVID is concerned, that we can offer a vaccine to, a test to, it will reduce transmission and help us all out in the long run.
We're winding up our segment series on COVID. Ray, how has COVID impacted Jackson County?
Yeah, so it has certainly impacted us in several really key ways. And I think it would behoove us to start with the most serious of that. And that is, you know, so far in since this pandemic began, we've lost over 1,000 lives, 1,072 lives to COVID right here in Jackson County. And that's not even necessarily including those lives we've lost in Independence, because we don't necessarily have that data right now. But, you know, across the metro, we've lost just over 2,500 people, 2,577 people, which is a substantial number of people, especially when we're talking about some of the things that, you know, we normally worry about in our kind of day-to-day lives. Losing that many people in, you know, such a relatively short time has far-reaching consequences, not only emotionally and socially, but you know, economically and you know, how we function as a community. And so that is probably the biggest way that we've measured it. But you know, there's also kind of the aspect of suffering and having to go through you know, an illness. You know, we've had a number of people in the Kansas City metro area who have been hospitalized, who have had to seek treatment. You know, so much so that we've overwhelmed our hospital system several times at this point in the Kansas City area. That's, you know, I don't necessarily want people to forget that. That's a substantial thing that we're talking about, that in the United States of America, our healthcare system has gotten to the point several times where we've had to either delay care for other conditions or, you know, straight out push that care back. So it's definitely been a substantial impact to us, regardless of, you know, the fact that some people don't have a terrible experience. They have mild symptoms and then they recover. But that's not the case for everyone, for sure.
And right now we're going through another one of those periods. I don't know if some people call this the second wave, the third wave, and in some cases the fourth wave. But we're in one of those cases right now where hospitals in Kansas City are bulging. People are waiting on gurneys in the hallway, and people that may have had heart attacks are being transported to hospitals. Hospitals are not being able to accept those patients. So it seems like this pandemic and this Delta variant that we're now dealing with is really throwing another load on back to the hospitals and our frontline healthcare workers.
That's 100% correct. And you know, the stories that we're hearing from the healthcare system, you know, do not necessarily bode well for us as not only a region but as a country. You know, we are literally burning out our healthcare professionals. You know, we already before this crisis had a shortage in some specialties. You know, our nursing profession in particular, we've always had hospitals looking for nurses, and you know, even before this crisis, we had shortages throughout the metro. And you know, the fact that we are really burying our healthcare professionals into the ground, so much so that they don't want to work in healthcare anymore. That's not acceptable. We shouldn't necessarily accept that. We shouldn't necessarily just kind of ignore that fact. And that's something that could have really serious repercussions. You know, even if we do get out of COVID, hopefully in the future, you know, that's, we're going to have long lasting repercussions from this crisis.
So if you're listening, you have a question for Ray, give us a call in our studio at 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. Ray, we are now dealing with not the Alpha variant, which came in that was infecting 2 to 3 people, but now a Delta variant that first hit the United States about in May of this year, that's within 120 days has become the predominant strain. And the Delta variant is so contagious, it transmits as easily as chickenpox, but also it will infect 8 to 9 people, and people have more COVID spores that they're expressing when they breathe. How is this impacting Kansas City? We went from no mask mandate back to a mask mandate. How is this directly impacting the city and the county?
Yeah, of course. It's absolutely no secret that the Delta variant in particular single-handedly changed the game. It changed our response. It changed the way we look at the virus. It changed our understanding of the virus in a variety of different ways. And you've mentioned several of those key points. You know, it's substantially more transmissible than the Alpha variant, and then also the ancestral strain that we initially saw. You know, we know that people are shedding the virus up to 1,000 times more than, you know, what we were seeing with Alpha and the ancestral strain. And the biggest thing, the thing that is actually resulting in, you know, a lot of what we're seeing today is that, you know, with Delta in particular, you know, we have seen some breakthrough infections, which is, you know, fully vaccinated individuals becoming infected, and not only becoming infected, but being able to still spread the virus. the good news and the silver lining, and there is certainly good news, is that it is actually not necessarily common. It's actually quite rare. We are still seeing the majority of transmission occurring in the region driven by unvaccinated populations. And so if you are vaccinated, you're not necessarily, you don't necessarily have the same risk as far as becoming infected. But if you are infected, you're not necessarily going to get as sick. We've seen a substantial decrease in the risk associated with hospitalization, with serious hospitalization and death. So it's definitely changing the game and changing our understanding, and it requires us to act differently. With what's going on right now and with the amount of transmission that we're seeing, it's requiring us to employ some of those mitigation measures that we used earlier on in the pandemic when we didn't necessarily have access to the vaccines. And these are, simple mitigation measures. They're not something that is outlandish or something new to us. They're just simple things that can do when we use them in conjunction with vaccines to lower the spread of transmission and reduce the burden on our healthcare systems.
I know that the governor in Texas who signed legislation preventing mask mandates now has come down and tested positive for COVID, and he has had his vaccinations. We look at what's going on in Mississippi, where they said they're totally overwhelmed by the surge of the Delta virus. Going back to school in Florida, there are counties in Florida that now have thousands of kids who are in quarantine who can't attend school because for those that are 12 and under, there is no vaccination. And there's also, for those that are in elementary school, they're not requiring them to wear masks. Georgia, which started school last week, now has 1,000 children who are in quarantine because of the spread of the Delta variant. These are areas where could we be seeing these type of things begin to happen in Jackson County and within the metropolitan area when our schools are now starting, some of them going back today, some of them going back on Monday. Could we begin to see those here?
Yeah, so that's our biggest fear. And I think that fear is predicated on doing nothing. So, as you alluded to, the biggest thing with the Delta variant is we're seeing it much more transmissible in children. Very early on with the Alpha strain, with the ancestral strain, we never saw outbreaks in daycares. We never saw them in summer camps. We never saw them in these child care settings. But that's changed this summer. We've have a number of outbreaks right now in daycares and summer camps and church camps with youth. And that is suggesting, and the overall evidence base is suggesting, that Delta is more transmissible in children than what we have seen before. And that has larger implications for us as a community. If we're perpetuating community spread and we allow our children to bear the brunt of spreading the virus in a school setting, which is a high-risk setting, then of course it just puts us in a terrible place as a community. And so, our goal as a health department and really as a society should be to do everything that we can to keep kids safe in an in-person learning setting. And to do that means that we need to employ some of those basic preventative measures that we have a really strong evidence base for that actually work, that, work in conjunction with each other. We say it's kind of like the Swiss cheese model, where nothing is perfect on its own, but if you layer different mitigation measures together, if you layer masking and ventilation and hand washing and vaccination and all of these things, we have a really, really good shot at preventing not only transmission but infection, which is what the goal should be. And so, I'm very, very proud of the steps that many school districts have taken throughout the metro to employ mask wearing. Nothing in this situation is easy. No one wants to wear a mask. I've yet to meet a single person in healthcare or in the general public that wants to wear a mask. But the situation that we are in requires action. It does not it does not require us to sit back and ignore what is going on in front of our faces. We have to take some sort of action. And masking is an important tool in the school setting, especially when our kids can't get vaccinated, to limit or interrupt transmission in that setting.
You mentioned something, and I want to piggyback on it for a second. What does Jackson County consider an outbreak?
Yeah, so there's kind of two different definitions that we follow. So any sort of situation where we have two or more linked cases is considered an outbreak internally. So that is something that our epidemiologists are going to be working, investigating, and trying to assist the organization, entity, family, whatever it is, in controlling. We also have a data dashboard where we list the outbreaks that we're currently working. And so for an outbreak to make it on that, it has to be five or more cases. And that's actually for privacy reasons. We don't want to get too few of people because then you can easily identify them. So on our data dashboard, it's five or more cases, and we list out, you know, where the outbreak is and what's going on in that particular situation.
And that's some great information in the data dashboard, folks. I looked at it and I could see different places where there have been outbreaks in Kansas City, the number of out cases. You can see the vaccination rates where ages right now are primarily being impacted. Ray, can you give that data dashboard, the website for that, so people maybe want to look at and gain more information, especially those within the county that can see, you know, places where they may need to be more vigilant and things that are actually going on and occurring and where a spread is becoming a problem in the community?
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. So if individuals want to view what's going on in Jackson County, it's simply on our website. So jacohd.org. And right on the homepage there's a big old button in the middle that says coronavirus. And you'll click on that and you'll go straight to our COVID page, which has our data dashboard on it. So there's a lot of good information on there. We have everything from case rates, what we're seeing as far as transmission, outbreaks, any sort of exposure situations, we'll list there as well. So there's a number of things that people can find there.
Ray, how long does an outbreak remain active?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So after we identify the last case, the situation has to go a full incubation cycle through before we can actually remove it. So 14 days after the last case, we will close an outbreak. We'll move it from an active investigation to a closed investigation. So that 14-day period is what we're looking for there.
And Ray, what does the county do when there is an active COVID outbreak? Do they contact all the people? Are they, are they backtrace and then people know there's been an outbreak in the place? I know there's been daycares, there's been senior living facilities. There have been a few other organizations and entities that have had outbreaks that are listed on you all's webpage. What's the county's position in that case when they have an outbreak?
Yeah, the good thing, public health has been working outbreaks for years, well before COVID happened. We have really, really excellent trained epidemiologists on staff. We have disease investigators on staff, that have been working outbreaks for everything from pertussis to measles well before COVID. And so, we had a really strong footing, as we entered COVID to respond in an effective manner that we know works. We didn't have to set anything up for this. And so the first step that we use in terms of working an outbreak for COVID in particular is really the identification of that initial case. So, as our team is doing the investigations, contacting individuals, talking to them, they identify an initial case in a high-risk setting. And they will basically work to try to link cases, through contact tracing, through talking to other people. And so, once we're able to identify by working with the organization that we, ensure that we've identified all of those individuals who are considered a close contact, then we'll employ, those measures like quarantine, where we'll basically monitor them to see if they develop symptoms. And that allows us to see the extent of the outbreak. It allows us to see who initially had the first case and how it moved through the organization or the entity or the event. And it allows us to interrupt transmission, which is very, very important. After that, after we've got kind of the core tenets of interrupting transmission down, we'll work with the business or entity to employ some of those additional mitigation measures that may be needed to ensure everyone is safe in that context. Maybe it's something that, you know, the organization needs to do to implement better hand washing policies. Maybe masking is necessary because they've seen a lot of transmission. And so we'll work with that business or entity to recommend some strategies that they can employ to not only, you know, end what they're currently experiencing, but also to prevent some of those things from happening again in the future.
Ray, has Jackson County started, unfortunately, we're in Delta right now, but unfortunately behind Delta is now the Lambda variant that has already made it to the United States, and it's in Texas and on the East Coast. Has Jackson County started looking at those communities that are now struggling with the Lambda variant and the Delta variant and kind of begin to make provisions here in Kansas City?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it kind of boils down to when we do nothing to stem the flow of transmission of this virus, you know, we're going to maintain risk associated with mutation. And that is what these other variants are. They're mutations of the virus that display different characteristics. Some of those characteristics are good for us. You know, it becomes less transmissible, less lethal, less serious. But sometimes, occasionally, you'll see characteristics that make it more difficult for us or more dangerous for us. And Lambda is a variant. It's one of the more recent mutations. It was discovered in Peru. And preliminary research is suggesting that it is not only just as transmissible as Delta. And right now, we think that it is just as transmissible, if not slightly more. But it appears that it is slightly more resistant to some of our primary mitigation measures, which are vaccines. And that's very dangerous. That's very bad for us as a society. If we think back to very early on in the pandemic, we had a strain of the virus that wasn't necessarily that transmissible. It doesn't have a high mortality rate, and yet it killed a lot of people. It wrecked havoc in our senior populations. And so if we get to the point where we have a variant that is completely resistant to our vaccines and is substantially more transmissible, that is not a good situation. That is the basis for why we need to interrupt transmission, why we need to do something. You know, we can't get in situations where we just let things run its course unless we're willing to sacrifice people. And that, from a morality standpoint, is not acceptable in my standpoint. So, you know, from our perspective, our goal and what we're trying to do with Delta, with Lambda, with other variants that come, we need to understand what's going on. We need to understand what variants are circulating in our community. And we need to respond appropriately as is. And so right now, our current course is the course to go. We need to continue vaccination. We need to continue to employ other mitigation strategies if we see some of our systems and structures get overwhelmed. And we just need to respond to the crisis in a responsible manner, and we'll be okay. We can interrupt transmission that way.
Ray, the Kansas City metropolitan area was on a list distributed by White House memo in May that showed this area was on a list of 10 areas where cases were expected to jump. And true to their data, it did. How closely is the county, or has the county had a chance to look at, you know, working with the people from the White House, from the Center for Disease Control, to begin to look at planning what may be future strategies when they see areas where projections of infections are scheduled to jump?
Yeah, so we follow a number of models here at the health department, a number of projections, and you know, we can't necessarily rely on every single one of them to forecast perfectly what's going to happen. But you know, in the case of what was reported in early May, you know, the writing was sort of on the wall. You know, we knew that the southern part of Missouri, you know, was already starting to see spikes in cases. You know, we received several different communications from our colleagues in the South to indicate what was going on. And so at that point, when we know that the virus is in the state, we know that the virus is, you know, just mere counties away from us, it's more than anything just a matter of time before the situation gets bad here as well. And so, you know, fortunately for us, I think we have the ability to employ mitigation measures that help to avert the worst of the crisis. You know, we've heard from some of our colleagues, some of our our healthcare professionals in the South, you know, who were begging for alternative care sites, tents basically, where you know people can be treated. They were begging for additional staffing, begging for additional resources. We don't want that to happen in Jackson County. That's not something that is acceptable. That's not something that you know, we should be okay with. We have very easy measures we can employ to avert the worst, and that's what we're trying to do right now. And you know, thankfully, we've been looking at this for a number of weeks, and you know, acting. You know, when we did, I think we can still do some good. And so that's why we would ask everyone to, you know, follow some of those mitigation measures like masking or getting vaccinated. It's really important for us to avert some of the worst characteristics of increases in transmission.
Ray, in some of those areas that were mentioned in that report, the one main thing was low rates of vaccination. What are the vaccination rates right now within Jackson County?
Yeah, that's a good question. That is certainly true. You know, a lot of those areas in the South had very, very low vaccination rates. Right here in Jackson County, of the total population, approximately 48% have initiated vaccination and 42% have completed. We also track it by the eligible population as well, so those people who are eligible for vaccines. And so in that case, 59% have initiated and 51% have completed of the eligible population. Unfortunately, we've made progress. That's good. I will not discount anything that we've done thus far, because it's been a struggle to get to where we have, but it's not necessarily adequate at this time. So we would like to see that number increase, you know, especially as we're dealing with Delta, that you know has the potential in a low number of cases to still infect people who are vaccinated. So we still need some work to do as a community to get those numbers up a little bit.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, about 42% within the county. So that means if I go into a room of 10 people, I can count out of those 10, 4 people that are fully vaccinated, which is essentially 1/3 of the room. 2/3 of the room is essentially not vaccinated.
Exactly. And you know, that's what we're seeing right now. You know, I think that everyone has kind of heard at this point, you know, that phrase, like, this is an outbreak of the unvaccinated. And you know, I think that if we just look at the data, if we don't say anything about, you know, labels or whatever, there's a substantial and distinct difference in our case rates between those who are vaccinated and unvaccinated. You know, nearly 3.5 times higher for those who are unvaccinated. You know, upwards of 600 per 100,000 for unvaccinated, and you're substantially lower, around the 150 to 200 mark for the vaccinated. You know, breakthrough cases are going to happen, but what is happening in the area is being driven by unvaccinated individuals getting infected, and we're seeing that translate into hospitalizations, serious hospitalizations. You know, if you talk to any of the hospitals in the area, the overwhelming majority of cases that are in the hospital right now are individuals who are unvaccinated. You know, those people who are on ventilators, overwhelming majority are unvaccinated individuals. And we don't want to wait until it's too late. You know, we've heard stories of people begging for the vaccine as they're in the hospital. It's too late at that point. You can't get the vaccine. It's not going to help you. So whatever we can do to get ahead of this thing a little bit and ensure that we're protecting all people, which is our goal, you know, we need to do that to the best of our ability.
Right. One thing we keep hearing, and people, I want to make sure people know what it means, is positivity rate. What is a positivity rate, and what is the current positivity rate in Jackson County?
Yeah, so the percent positive is an indicator that we use. It tells us a number of things. It not only looks at The proportion of individuals who are testing positive for COVID out of all of those people being tested, that's the primary definition of percent positive. Right now it's at 16%, and while it's not necessarily been the highest point we've ever reached, I think we've been in the low 20s in our first massive wave. It's certainly very, very high, given that we now have vaccines. And so percent positive is also used as an indication of testing. And so the thought or the idea is that you should be testing, you should increase your testing to a point where you're starting to drive your percent positive down, just because you're altering that proportion. And so the fact that we're seeing increasing testing, but our percent positive is still increasing, is an indication that we're not testing enough. We're not able to drive the percent positive down, because the proportion is still suggesting that we're finding more cases, so to speak. And so it's used two ways in that manner, but it's something that's important to look at with some of these other metrics to tell us what's going on.
So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Kansas City's community radio station. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today our guest is Ray Delecki, who is the Assistant Community Health Director for Jackson County. Stay tuned. Right back after this short break. We're back. This is Joseph Jackson, hosting Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM. And our guest today is Mr. Ray Delecki, who is the Assistant Community Health Director for Jackson County. Ray, right now the data dashboard shows that Jackson County is seeing an increase in COVID cases in those from 10 to 14 years old. Why is this group seeing an increase in COVID cases when in the original Alpha strain, not many children were being infected by the COVID virus?
Yeah, so right now the evidence base is suggesting that, you know, Delta is much more transmissible. And, you know, as we kind of mentioned before, the reason that we're seeing it as much more transmissible is really twofold. Infected individuals are shedding up to 1,000 times more virus than what we've previously seen. And then we also know that infected individuals are becoming infectious sooner than with some of the other previous variants. And so what that leads us to understand as far as children are concerned is that in certain settings, you know, we know that Delta has the ability to infect children more so than what we've seen with some of the other variants, but also children, as they're becoming infected and shedding the virus, they can infect other children. And so, you know, right now we've seen increasing rates really since Delta arrived in not only those 10 to 14 years of age, but also 15 to 19. And when you couple that with vaccination, which is our best measure for mitigation, that's definitely concerning, because we have fewer strategies we can employ to interrupt transmission. And that's our goal. We don't want kids to be infected. You know, we want to interrupt transmission where we can. And, you know, if we only have certain things to employ, then it becomes that much more difficult to be successful. And so, you know, it's important where, you know, that's kind of where the masking and some of these other mitigation strategies become very, very important as we move forward.
Ray, as you talk vaccinations, what vaccinations are available from or through the Jackson County Health Department?
Yeah, so right now we have all three manufacturers of vaccine available at the health department. You know, Pfizer is the one that most people are getting. And I think primarily the reason for that is, you know, we have that younger approved population. You know, we haven't seen as much demand for Moderna. I think, you know, mainly because it's not necessarily approved for those, you know, 12 to 18 at this point. And so I think that will change as, you know, as we see some of those additional approvals. But we have all three. You know, we usually take them to our various clinics, and, you know, people can request them as long as we don't run out of a certain vaccine out in the community. You know, they can request what they want. We still have people getting Johnson & Johnson. You know, some people don't like shots, and, you know, they just want that one shot and done, and so they get Johnson & Johnson. And so, you know, we try to give people options, and we try to make sure that, you know, we're working to make it as convenient as we can for people based on what they'd like to get.
I know this It was broadcast this morning to Garth Brooks, who just did a big concert here with over 70,000 people in attendance, is suspending his concert tours. You know, where they were, they had people at the concert, you know, handing out vaccinations. As we see higher and higher positivity rates, you know, did we experience any community spread from that particular event, or is it too soon to know yet?
Yeah, so, you know, I would say that it is probably a little bit too soon. And the main reasons for that are really kind of telling as far as the situation that we're in. So, you know, like our hospitals, many of our local public health agencies in the metro are just simply overwhelmed at the moment. And so, you know, many of them are 1,000 to 2,000 cases behind as far as case investigation is concerned. And so, you know, the ability to identify those cases and link them to specific events is in a lot of question. It's in a kind of a serious place right now, and we need that. We need to be able to say, you know, this case is linked to this event. Let's try to interrupt transmission before it kind of spreads out of control. You know, if we can't do that because we're so behind, then, you know, we just allow this transmission to occur in our communities. And so, you know, I would be extremely skeptical of anyone who said, you know, we have no cases linked to a single event, because we just don't know. We don't have that information readily available in a strong manner. You know, based on some of our models of previous situations with the Delta variant across the country, as far as concerts and events are concerned, you know, I think we could easily conservatively estimate 600 plus cases from an event of that size. And so, you know, just because, you know, we don't have the ability to investigate because our capacity is strained across the health structure or system, you know, we need to be real with the situation. And you know, estimates like that will give us an understanding of what the implications are down the road as we move forward.
And well, a lot of that, though, there were people who came from the four-state region to that concert. So you all may not find out that somebody in Nebraska, Iowa, you know, Arkansas, Oklahoma tested positive for a virus because they came here, they stayed for 1 or 2 days, and then they went back home. And by the time they were tested positive, it was maybe back in another region that if you all not working with them, you wouldn't know.
Exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of it stems from, you know, antiquated and simply ineffective data systems that exist in the United States as far as the public health system is concerned. You know, we've neglected the system and the structure for years. And, you know, at this point, as far as data systems, you know, the data system from one state to another is completely different. It doesn't allow for that quick transfer of a case. You know, if someone, you know, came from Iowa to the Garth Brooks concert and went back home, tested positive, it might be weeks and weeks and weeks until we get that lab report eventually funneled to us because it's antiquated. I mean, for crying out loud, they use faxing sometimes. And I understand that some people use faxing, and that's great. But if time is of the essence and you really need to understand what's going on, we need better structures in this country to ensure that we're able to respond to pandemics. This will not be the last pandemic that we face as a country. And, you know, we have certain parts of the country that are well prepared to respond to threats, you know, kind of foreign threats. And viruses should be right up there with them. We should have a robust structure in place to ensure that we have the ability, you know, if we are having these events, to communicate with our partners across other states, because viruses know no jurisdictional lines. They don't follow state boundaries. They don't follow jurisdictional boundaries. We need an ability to respond effectively to that stuff. And that needs to be a lesson learned from this pandemic as we move forward.
We've got to move to this topic that brought a lot of heat last night. Kansas City has a mask mandate, but many people may not know that Jackson County has implemented a mask mandate. Why did Jackson County implement a mask mandate, Ray?
Yeah, I think there are really several factors that we look at. You know, it's never a simple single thing. It's never an easy decision. You know, I think if you look at our rate of transmission in Jackson County, it's out of control right now. It's simply out of control. The CDC puts us and most of Missouri in the highest category of transmission that they have. This means more infection, more illness, more possibilities of mutation. And, you know, what we talked about earlier is kind of the, you know, from my perspective, the easiest thing to understand, that enormous strain on our healthcare systems. Anytime we're listening to physicians and nurses tell us that they're having to stage people, you know, in an ER hallway waiting for a room, or they're having to say, no, don't come to this hospital if you have a heart attack patient or a stroke patient, that's simply unacceptable. And so, you know, with that realization, you know, we needed to employ additional mitigation strategies. And that's how this pandemic works. It's not something that is, you know, cut and dry. It requires us to be adaptive. It requires us to be nimble. And based on the situation we find ourselves in, we might need to employ other strategies, like a mask mandate, to interrupt or better interrupt transmission. You know, regardless of a lot of the conjecture and noise out there, the scientific base of evidence for masking as, you know, just another strategy that we have, an effective strategy that we have to do something about transmission, is solid. You know, the amount of studies that we have the CDC, we have the WHO, we have the American Academy of Pediatrics, brilliant scientists from across the nation and across the world looking at the total body of evidence and saying, this is a strategy we can use to do something. And so, you know, that's kind of our next logical step. If we know there's a crisis, we have to respond responsibly, we have to respond appropriately, and we have to do what we can to, you know, prevent the situation from getting worse, which we don't want to happen.
Ray, when does the mask mandate for Jackson County expire? And are you all possibly looking at extending that mandate?
Yeah, so right now there's not like a firm expiration date on the mask mandate. I will say that last week of August we will be reevaluating the mask mandate. We will be updating our data sets, our reports, and we will also be having conversations with some of our elected officials about what's an appropriate step as we move forward. So, you know, I expect we'll continue to look at the trends over the next couple of weeks, and then more than likely we'll start having those conversations about, you know, whether we need to extend it. My guess is, just based on some of the trends that we're seeing, unfortunately, we haven't seen substantial change, just because it's only been about 2 weeks or so. You know, we might need it a little bit longer, but we'll come to some of those decisions in the near future, hopefully.
Ray, the federal government dropped a bombshell and said they've now approved a third shot, or they're calling it a booster, but it's actually a third shot. But there is for the immunocompromised first. What is meant by the term immunocompromised?
Yeah. So, initially the federal government had approved, that third dose or booster for those individuals who are immunocompromised. And, you know, there's kind of a broad definition of what that means. They don't necessarily list all of the conditions that would apply to, excuse me. But it could mean, you know, immune compromised due to a solid organ transplant, or if you're taking immune suppressing medications. You know, it could be you're immune compromised due to an active treatment for a solid tumor. It could be, you know, HIV, if you have, if you're immune compromised due to advanced or untreated HIV infection, or, you know, if you have high dose steroids that you're taking. There's a whole host of different categories, basically, as far as, you know, what would make someone immune compromised. If anyone meets some of those definitions, you know, they can get this booster at really any one of our vaccine clinics. They just simply need to read through an attestation that goes through the entire list, and they need to sign it. And if they have specific questions, you know, I encourage people to talk to their doctors, talk to their primary care providers that they're seeking treatment for these conditions, and determine what's appropriate for them, because the doctor will better understand their specific conditions. But That's the first piece of this. And then yesterday, the federal government announced also, in addition to that, a third dose or a booster for all individuals who have taken mRNA vaccines, and so that's the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, and that they're asking that to be 8 months, at least 8 months, so no sooner than 8 months after your second dose. And so preliminarily, they plan on that starting September 20th. You know, we were alerted to this yesterday, the same as everyone else. We found out about this yesterday, the same as everyone else. So we are certainly in the planning stage of trying to figure out how this works. You know, we gave over close to 80,000 doses, and so being prepared to do that again will require us to more than likely set up a mass vaccination site again. It will require us to staff up again and kind of do what we've done before, working with some of our partners. So I expect more information will come out about that over the coming days and weeks. We'll hopefully provide some more information as to like when this might be, the specific instances that people will have to look for. But in general, what we know, at least right now, it's 8 months post your second dose. And it's for individuals who received those two vaccines that I mentioned, the Pfizer or Moderna. Right now, there's not any specific guidance for the Johnson & Johnson booster that's been talked about, but I do expect more information will come out over the coming weeks about that particular one. But the health department, you can follow the health department on any of the social media platforms. You can go to our website, you can give us a call. We will keep people informed as to what's going on. We'll provide answers to their questions, and hopefully sooner rather than later we'll have that concrete plan based on this kind of, as you mentioned, bombshell that came out yesterday, that we can provide details for people.
So Ray, when can those who are immunocompromised start getting their boosters? I know Hy-Vee has started advertising it. When will Jackson County start giving boosters or third shots to those who are immunocompromised?
Yeah, great question. So we've actually already started giving additional doses for those individuals who are immunocompromised. People can come to any one of our vaccine clinics. Those clinics are listed on our website. We have a calendar of events where you can click on and find a clinic that's near you, and it's just a really simple and easy process. So, that's something that is currently in play and active, and anyone who meets that criteria, I really encourage to take advantage of that. These vaccines, just like the other ones, will be completely free. You won't be asked to provide a driver's license or your insurance information at our clinics. It's something that is, should be free and easy and accessible to all people who meet that definition.
So, Ray, will people need their vaccine cards? Because I know a lot of people, as soon as they got the second dose, the card may be here, there, wherever. I know I personally took a picture of mine on my cell phone, so I've always got it. And if I need it, I could print it out and use it to get that third shot on. But what happens if they've lost that vaccine card at this point?
Yeah, so unfortunately, that is something that we're running into more and more. I think your idea of keeping that separate record is certainly a very good idea as far as making sure that you have that information easily accessible if you're out and about in the community and you need it. We've asked people to hold on to their vaccine cards. Those cards are where we're going to dictate any additional doses that they're going to receive. So if they're immunocompromised, it'll go on there. If they're getting that third dose or that booster 8 months after their second dose, it'll go on there. You need to bring that card, if you have it, to whatever clinic you're attending, so that we can make sure we're keeping your records accurate and active. Thankfully, we do have backup systems. So, if you have lost it or if it's substantially damaged, we've received a lot of calls about some washing machines attacking these cards. you know, it is something that we have a state system that we can print records from. You know, so I will say if you have lost it or if it's damaged, contact your initial provider, the one who gave you the vaccine initially. All of those individuals have access to the state system. They can print those records. It's a medical records request, basically, is what you're doing. And you can get that information, and that will work for you. So, you know, we have backups. We have the ability to look it up, but just go to your initial provider, and they should be able to help you out.
Ray, it's getting that time when people start looking at getting a flu shot starting next month. Can they get that flu shot and that third vaccine booster at the same time?
Yeah, so this is kind of a distinction from some of the other vaccines. You know, we've been actually offering COVID with some of the other back to school vaccines. That's been something that is completely fine and safe. Out of an abundance of caution with seasonal flu, we do ask that it be broken up by about 14 days. And so if you're getting the COVID vaccine first, you know, we recommend waiting about 14 days for that flu vaccine, which is important as well. So that is slightly different than what we've seen with some of these other vaccines, but something to take note of.
So, Ray, the Raiders have said that anyone who wants to attend a game in a Lions stadium must be fully vaccinated. The Chiefs have stated that to go to the game day experience on the field, you must be fully vaccinated. Does the health department have any plans to partner to provide vaccinations during Chiefs home games?
Yeah, so Arrowhead Stadium, or I should say it's like Gia Field at Arrowhead. I don't know. It's Arrowhead Stadium, basically. You know, we've been out there several times as far as, you know, the mass vaccination clinics that we've done in the parking lot. And, you know, Kansas City Health Department primarily has jurisdiction over that particular stadium, or the stadiums in general. But we've always been willing to support vaccination clinics throughout Jackson County. We have a specific team that's been really going throughout the community. We've already partnered with some other really important organizations throughout the metro area to provide opportunities at Royal Stadium. And so, you know, if there's a need there and, you know, we can work out logistical items with the Chiefs, I'm sure that, you know, we'd be more than happy to offer that. You know, I know that, you know, Wyandotte County Health Department across the state line, you know, they've been really active out at sporting games, you know, just as far as providing that opportunity and that convenience for people. And so, you know, wherever we can make it convenient for people, you know, I think it would be good for us as a community. You know, even if it is a lower number, even if it's 50 shots or whatever, that's something that can interrupt transmission. If you're talking about 5 to 8 other people being infected, it adds up very quickly.
Ray, can you give out the number and the website again for Jackson County Health Department?
Yeah, of course. So our website is really a wealth of information. You know, not only can you get information from the site about what's going on with COVID, where you can find vaccines, where you can find testing, but it has a really important data as far as what's going on with the pandemic. And so I would encourage people to go there first. It's jacohd.org. They can also get in touch with us through that website. And oftentimes, because we are seeing a higher volume of calls, it's a more efficient way to get in touch with us. So I would start there. If you don't have access to the internet or the website, or if it's not working, you know, 816-404-6415 will reach us at the health department, and we can, you know, direct you where you need to go based on your needs. If it's something you need help with an outbreak, if it's something you want information about testing or vaccination, you know, we're really here for the community to help them out and do what we can to answer their questions.
So you heard of folks, 404-6515, was that correct?
It was 404-6415, yep.
404-6415, if you're looking to get information on getting tested. So I would like to thank Mr. Dulecki for being our guest today. We never end Cowtown Conversations without a Community Minute. And this weekend, Ivanhoe is having a community vaccination event on Saturday, August 21st from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. There will be free food and school supplies for children at the Ivanhoe Community Center located at 3700 Woodlands. So coming out this Saturday from 10 to 2. If you need help finding a vaccine location, go to vaccines.gov to find a vaccine location near you, or call 1-800-232-0233. Councilman Brandon Ellington is taking the lead to ensure that those who need food during this pandemic don't go hungry, and he set up drive-through food banks. The next food bank will be this Saturday, August 21st, at Mount Sinai Church, located at 3634 Brooklyn, and the food will be distributed from 10 a.m. to noon. Join us next week as our guest will be Stacy Johnson Crosby, and she'll be talking about resources to help those pay their utilities and rental during these pandemic times. So for Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Have a great day. Stay safe, wear a mask, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J.
Mm-hmm.